Let's take over to Tracy Hall, who's going to tell you how we made the diamond.
Dr. Bundy has outlined for you the thermodynamic requirements to be met to place a system in the diamond stable region. He has also described equipment for meeting these requirements. In connection with this equipment, I'd like to say something about Francis. You never know how cold the water is until someone jumps in and finds out. Well, Francis jumped in. His initial work in the high-temperature, high-pressure field was basic to the success of this project. Now, the ideal way to make diamond would be to start with a non-diamond carbon, such as graphite, and convert it in toto to diamond by subjecting it to diamond-stable conditions. This should be done at a high enough temperature such that the reaction takes place in a reasonable time. The first high-pressure experiments performed on the superpressure project were attempts to transform graphite to diamond. These were conducted in November of 1951 by Dr. F.P. Bundy in Operation Hot Shot. Bundy shot 1/120th second pulses of current through a thin disk of graphite in a Bridgman flat-faced anvil apparatus. The pressure was 150,000 atmospheres and the temperature 1,400 degrees C. Bundy had hoped to reach 2,500 degrees C. But the resistance of the sample turned out to be about that, one half of that expected. And because of equipment limitations, this limited the temperature to 1400 C. The next attempts to make diamond by direct conversion were made a year ago in the Belt apparatus. A little later, the same sort of experiments were conducted in the Belt at 100,000 atmospheres. In these experiments, pressure and temperature were maintained for an hour or more, and temperatures were very slowly reduced while maintaining the pressure. Temperatures, by conservative extrapolation, ranged to as high as 4,500 degrees centigrade. No diamond formation was observed. When a chemist, or a physicist for that matter, cannot make a reaction proceed at a measurable rate in a thermodynamically stable region, he looks for a catalyst or an indirect system to provide a favorable reaction path. Actually, this was anticipated in advance of direct conversion experiments. Dr. Wintorf may well have been the first to find such a path. In May 1953, he found faint X-ray evidence of diamond formation in a lithium carbide iron system, which had been subjected to 40,000 atmospheres at about 1,100 degrees C. The evidence was not conclusive, however. Faint X-ray evidence was, at about this same period, also found in systems in which carbonates were reduced at high pressure and temperature. Dr. Strong, who has had a great deal of interest in iron-carbon systems, was, about a year ago, getting some X-ray evidence of diamond formation. Again, however, this evidence was inconclusive. These are just a couple of citations of the sort of thing that has been going on. Actually, we have performed hundreds and hundreds of experiments in attempts to make diamond. And if you can think of a system, we've already tried it. This is the laboratory's first diamond. At least where the evidence was conclusive and unequivocal that the material is diamond. The length of this crystal is about 1.2 millimeters. It was grown by Dr. Strong in the first apparatus described by Dr. Bundy. In comparison to the tip of the phonograph needle, you can see that it would make several of them. Let me quote in part from Dr. Strong's synthesis report. On December the 8th, 1954, two diamond octahedra were placed in separate envelopes of pure iron sheet. These were surrounded with a steel carburizing mixture called Stecco, a mixture of charcoal, coke, and barium carbonate. In this experiment, a pressure of 53,500 atmospheres and a temperature of 1,300 degrees C was maintained on the sample for 16 hours. Upon opening the pressure chamber, the two diamond octahedra seed crystals were recovered unchanged. The iron of one of the samples had partially melted and two new distinct diamond crystals had grown out from it. The iron, then, was the catalyst in Dr. Strong's reaction. We are indebted to Dr. Horn for this photograph and the photograph of diamonds that follow. At the present time, it has not been possible to grow additional diamonds under the original conditions used by Dr. Strong. That is 53,500 atmospheres and 1,300 degrees C. However, with suitable catalyst, diamonds are readily and reproducibly grown at 95,000 atmospheres and temperatures between 1,400 degrees and 1,900 degrees C. This temperature is the temperature measured midway between the ends of the capsule here in this high-pressure apparatus. The temperature at the end is approximately 150 to 200 degrees cooler than it is at the center. The first catalyst employed under these conditions was iron sulfide. Iron sulfide was rammed into this hole in the graphite tube. After heating 3 minutes at 1,700 degrees C and 95,000 atmospheres, temperature was reduced to room temperature, followed by a lowering of the pressure. Diamonds were formed on these end disks, which are made of tantalum. Analysis of the current voltage relationships in the heating circuit indicated that the diamonds had grown in a period of about 15 seconds. These diamonds, although tiny, were first seen with the unaided eye on opening the capsule. This was possible because the diamonds grew with many of the triangular faces of the octahedron showing. Because of diamonds' high refractive index, an almost metallic reflection was obtained from these triangles. This slide gives an idea of what was seen. Here are the triangular faces of the octahedra giving an almost metallic reflection. They grow as an aggregate, a group of crystals oriented in many directions. The masses of these crystals have weighed up to a tenth of a carat. Just the other day, Hal Bolmaker succeeded in growing a mass of these crystals that weighed a quarter of a carat. These fragments were broken from the polycrystalline mass that you saw in the previous slide. Note this triangular face of an octahedra. The triangular face in this case is about 200 microns on edge. Just this past week, Dr. Wentor succeeded in growing some of these where they were 1,000 microns or 0.04 of an inch on edge. Since iron sulfide served as catalyst at 95,000 atmospheres and 1,700 degrees C, iron alone was tried and also worked. Sulfur alone did not work. Soon after the above conditions for diamond synthesis were discovered, Dr. Hugh Woodbury duplicated the iron sulfide experiment for patent purposes. A little later, a task force, Drs. Marshall, Lawson, Hebb, and Holloman, had Dr. Woodbury and Dr. R.A. Oriani duplicate the iron sulfide experiment using independent sources of starting material to which we did not have access. This they did and proved to everyone's satisfaction that diamond could be reproducibly made. Diamonds have now been made over 75 times at 95,000 atmospheres and temperatures in the region of 1,400 to 1,900 degrees C. Everyone on the project, using his own pet method, is growing diamonds under these conditions. Dr. Wentor set himself the task of classifying the materials that would act as catalysts. He has found sodium, tantalum, aluminum, manganese, chromium, nickel, cobalt, and palladium to be effective. Dr. Bundy is studying the iron graphite system using various means, including geometrical conditions, to clearly understand the mechanism of this system. Dr. Strong with E. Cheney and H.P. Bolvenkirk is studying iron carbon and nickel carbon systems. Let's now view some additional slides of diamonds made in the laboratory. This is an enlargement of the triangular face in the previous slide. Note the triangles within triangles. This is characteristic of diamonds made in the laboratory as well as characteristic of diamonds found in nature. Here is a diamond octahedron. I believe you can see a couple of the triangular faces, and actually the complete thing is an octahedron. Here are some water white crystals grown by Hal Bolvenkirk. They're about as transparent as any that we have seen as yet. I believe you can see right through some of these. The dimensions of all these crystals are about the same, somewhere in the range of 100 to 400ths of an inch across their longest dimension. Here is a beautiful little specimen grown by Jim Cheney. You can see the triangular face of an octahedron sticking out from this polycrystalline aggregate of diamond that is growing in this ring. Here are some roundish octahedron. They're found the same way in nature, a strong tendency to grow in a roundish sort of an octahedron. I believe you can see that these are also transparent crystals. Here is some more crystallinity on the face of another crystal. Here's another triangular face. I believe that you can make out, although the depth of focus is not too great, that is actually another octahedron. Now, in order to try and make this thing a little more real to you, we have an apparatus here that is used in medicine. And we would like to show some actual diamonds. Now, Dr. Horn has got some of these on a slide behind me, and he is going to view these through a microscope, and you're going to see them projected via this color television microscope on the screen at my right. Now, they should look to you just as they would look if you were looking right in the microscope yourself. Neer had made the remark when we were trying this out this morning that he was not sure that this apparatus was compatible with the color of our diamond. How are we doing? We lost the video. Next
start, Chris, what you say will be very, very similar to the things that you've already looked at. Diamond, and they are also racers in the diamond. You see that both ways.